You're with us on The Morning Show as we talk about bus transportation amid the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Buses provide an essential service, getting us to work, medical appointments, the grocery store. Transit agencies are watching their revenues shrivel up while trying to redesign their systems to keep passengers spread out more and buses disinfected around the clock. Have you been riding the bus throughout the pandemic? What changes have you noticed? Are you a longtime bus rider who is now afraid to board the bus? What do you want to know? We're at 800-642-1234. Derek Mink is Director of Parking and Transit for the City of Sheboygan, which operates Shoreline Metro, serving Sheboygan, Sheboygan Falls, and Kohler. Derek, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And we also have Justin Stuenberg, who is Madison Metro's new general manager. And the 2018 ridership numbers, Madison Metro provided more than 13 million rides. Justin, welcome to you and welcome to Wisconsin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with you, Justin. 13 million rides in the 2018 numbers. What is ridership like now?
It's significantly reduced in the 2,000 to 4,000 range right now.
2,000 to 4,000 range. And so have you seen, is that, you know, have you seen any bumps there at all? Or is it, are those buses consistently without riders?
It's been low across the board, but we are starting to see a little bit of activity pick up now that we've entered some of our reopening plans. But it's been pretty slow with as we've come back.
Derek, what are ridership numbers looking like for you? How off are they?
Like Justin said, we've seen reduced ridership across the board, both of our services, both fixed route and our paratransit ADA service. Ridership's down about 75%, but we've seen the increase of customers coming back these last couple of weeks as businesses start opening up and employees start returning to work. But yeah, it's been down. We hope that with businesses and jobs coming back online, that ridership will continue to grow, especially as we reintroduce service back into the mix here.
Justin, you know, Madison Metro had one driver test positive for the coronavirus in March. What do you know about that case?
So I just started a little over 3 weeks ago, so I don't have the full details of what their status is, but we do know that we have not had any more positive tests since that time.
How often are bus drivers tested?
Dane County in Madison has set up an unlimited testing site where anybody can come get tested whenever they want. We are not at this point requiring all of our operators to get tested. But we are certainly encouraging them to do so if they have any symptoms or have come into contact with anyone that has had symptoms.
Derek, how are you handling testing for your drivers?
Again, as Justin stated, we are following a very similar policy. We are not testing our drivers at this point. We've not had any cases or outbreaks within our system at this point. So we are encouraging our employees to stay home, stay out of work if they are experiencing symptoms, especially related to the virus. And we are encouraging them to seek out testing if that opportunity should exist for them.
We're talking about public buses during the pandemic. We have Justin Stuenberg, head of Madison Metro, Derek Mink here as well, who leads Shoreline Metro in the Sheboygan area. You can join in. Is riding the bus your only option to get to work? And if so, do you feel more at risk? What etiquette do you hope fellow passengers follow when they start riding the bus again? Join in at 800-642-1234. Justin, take us on a tour of the bus, if you will. What is Metro doing to keep riders safe and drivers safe on these buses?
So currently we are not collecting fares, and we're asking passengers to board and alight through the rear doors so that they're not coming in close contact with the bus driver. And we're also asking folks to stay distanced when they're on the bus and limiting passenger capacities to about 15 on the bus at any given time. However, as we are seeing some passenger activity start to pick back up, you know, that's probably not a sustainable thing to go through the entire summer with. So we are actively exploring additional measures that we can take to protect both passengers and our drivers to hopefully restore fare collection as well as allow some additional capacity on the bus.
And you're operating on a Saturday service, is that right?
More or less, with some slight adjustments to it, but mostly essentially a Saturday service.
What is the cleaning protocol like on your buses?
So here in Madison, we are we're cleaning the buses much more stringently than we had in the past with disinfectant cleaners inside the bus. We're also, so just to give you a sense of scale, we typically had about three people dedicated to detailing the insides of the bus at any given night. That number right now is around 30. So wow. It's about a 10 times increase in the amount of money that we're spending to clean and disinfect the buses. We're also, rather than having drivers relieve each other out in the field, so typically we would have a bus stay out in the field and employ a driver go out and take over that bus in the middle of its route. We have instead instituted a strategy where we're sending a new, fresh, clean bus out with every single driver so that they're not taking over the driver's compartment from someone else that but without being cleaned in between.
Okay, so that every new driver enters a freshly disinfected bus.
Correct. But again, that will not be sustainable as we start to ramp up service. We just don't have enough buses to do that when our service levels are higher.
Derek, take us on a tour of your buses. How what has changed on them? How are you keeping them safe and clean?
Well, again, it's going to be a lot of what Justin just said. We have limited our capacity to 10 riders at this point. Again, not sustainable as we can continue to ramp up our service and welcome customers back. We do plan on increasing that to 15 on June 8th. We are also practicing several other things similar to what Justin mentioned about Madden. We aren't collecting fares currently. We are continuing to emphasize that customers make only those essential trips. But we're seeing a lot more choice rides at this point. We are also ramping up our cleaning. Again, we're a little bit smaller than Madison, but nevertheless, cleaning and sanitizing and detailing our buses and facilities have become of utmost importance. So we've ramped that up significantly. We continue to encourage our passengers to wear masks and gloves if appropriate. Same thing with our drivers and employees, and also encouraging that social distancing on board. Again, that's going to be one of those concerns as we continue to see increase in ridership and trying to increase capacity alongside that.
So when you do social distancing on board, is it, you know, how are you spacing people out?
The drivers are really encouraging individuals that especially aren't living in the same household sit at least every other seat or every other row at this point. Mm-hmm. We've been able to maintain that very effectively. I'd say about 95% of the time we can accommodate that. We'll see members of the same household sitting right next to each other. But otherwise, customers have done a great job of separating themselves from other customers. But again, as we continue to increase our capacity, you know, we're going to see some people probably standing and we're going to have continued emphasis people sit apart from one another.
Derek Mink there, who leads Shoreline Metro in the Sheboygan area. Justin Steuenberg, he's here, head of Madison Metro. And you, your questions about riding the bus, how do you feel about it? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what it's like riding the bus during the pandemic. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Madison, as we've learned, buses are running with 15 passengers max. No fare collection right now. In Milwaukee, fares resume Monday with front door boarding on all buses, but still 10 riders max. Have you been unable to get on a bus because of new limits on the number of passengers? Did it make you late for work or an appointment? Are you a city bus driver? Do you worry about your safety? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. We're talking with Derek Mink, Director of Parking and Transit for the City of Sheboygan, which operates Shoreline Metro, and Justin Stuenberg, who's General Manager of Madison Metro. They stay with us. Justin, I've heard, as we've talked here, you've said some things about, you know, these changes being not sustainable. And you've been on the job now just about a month. What is it like taking over in this crisis and doing things that you know you can't sustain for the long term?
It's definitely a wild time to step into this role. There's no doubt about that. It's very important to me to make sure that we're doing things that we can sustain well into the future, both financially and operationally. You know, I was fortunate to have an interim general manager in place before I took over, who instituted a lot of these changes rapidly in March and April. And so she really set the table well for me. Right now I'm really in the position to figuring out where we go from here. Basically, how do we start to restore service in a safe way for our passengers, but also a sustainable economic way that we are able to provide that service well into the future. And so there will be some impacts to our long-term finances from this, as well as obviously to the short term. So trying to manage all of that has certainly been a challenge, but we're digging in to that very closely and trying to figure out how best to move forward.
And Derek, you're the treasurer of the Wisconsin Public Transportation Association. When you look at finances, what variety are you seeing out there on how Wisconsin's bus systems are responding right now and trying to make budget?
Wow. Yeah, a lot of what Justin just said, relating to making decisions for the long term. One thing that should be stated is that, you know, public transportation is a vital service that many communities in the state of Wisconsin provide. And it doesn't have to be fixed route. It doesn't have to be the large bus services. We've got many, many communities that provide a shared ride taxi or demand response door-to-door services that are vital to their communities. So all of us are really struggling right now with a loss in revenues, increased expenses due to additional cleaning, sanitizing of vehicles, keeping customers safe, keeping employees safe. And so we're all really battling that that loss in revenue, increase in expenses right now, and all forced to make decisions that keep employees and customers safe while trying to bring back normal or regular service to their communities. And it has been a struggle. But we all, I think, in the transit world, understand the importance of public transportation. The services that we do provide are critical to not only the community, but the customers that use them for work, for medical appointments, for schooling, education, things like that. So we're all struggling right now to bring back regular service in a safe manner, but we all know the importance of public transportation to our communities.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about riding the bus amid the pandemic. That is Derek Mink, who leads Shoreline Metro in the Sheboygan area. We're also talking with Justin Stuenberg, who has just taken over as general manager of Madison Metro. And your questions about riding the bus and insights that you're seeing in public transportation in your community, 800-642-1234. Justin, I want to look at the federal stimulus. How is Madison Metro using the roughly $23 million it's expected to get from the CARES Act?
So we're developing the details around that plan right now, but a good portion of that will go towards operating expenses. As you can imagine, we've had a major reduction in fare revenue. Madison Metro is actually quite high in terms of our fare box recovery ratio, which means the amount of our budget that comes from fares is actually nearly a quarter of our budget. And so that loss of fare revenue has been a big, big hit for us. And so it certainly will go towards filling that gap. It'll also go towards the additional costs we're experiencing because of the additional cleaning that we're doing, as well as the purchase of all the personal protective equipment. And then, you know, our city partners, so we are a part of the city of Madison, but we also contract for service to many of the suburban cities around Madison. And all of these city budgets are experiencing, you know, major hits because of lost tax revenue. And so a portion of it will also go towards helping reduce the burden on all of our partner cities. And then we hope to be able to use some for capital expenses to reduce our future debt obligations. But we're taking a bit of a wait and see approach on that.
What is the timeline for seeing that money in your budget? Do you know?
So we're actually going through the process right now of in the federal systems of technically applying for it, which brings it from just the federal allocation actually into our FTA, Federal Transit Administration account that we can draw on. You know, typically that process takes a few months. And so I would hope certainly by the fall that money would be available to draw upon.
And Shoreline received about $3.5 million from the Federal CARES Act. Is that right, Derek?
Yes, that is correct.
How are you using those funds?
Again, very similar to Madison Metro. We are going to be focused on recovering the lost fares, the lost revenue that we normally would have taken in through customer fares. Advertising revenues, things like that. Also to offset our increased expenses. Fortunately, fuel prices have remained very, very low. I think one of my mechanics actually quoted that he hasn't paid for fuel that low in almost 20 years. So it's very fortunate that that expense has stayed low. But again, just trying to make our budgets come out, provide some relief to the city of Sheboygan, and also look at opportunities to provide some tax relief to our partner communities, Village of Kohler, City of Sheboygan Falls, as well through this pandemic. So that's going to be our first and foremost priority, I think, for this year and for next year. And if we do have any available funds remaining, we will focus on some capital projects as well.
Justin, you know, bus ridership in Madison has been trending upward for two decades. Are you concerned that the pandemic will shake people's faith in mass transit and they'll drive more?
I think certainly in the short term, that's a very significant concern. You know, Madison, you know, does have a few kind of advantages for transit, both the university, the dense downtown, as well as the lakes forming some geographic barriers to, you know, to adding new road capacity. So I think there is some limits to how much people could drive anyway. And so that's why Madison Metro is an extremely important part of the community and will continue to be. Certainly, I expect a short-term reduction in ridership. You know, we'll be working hard to make sure that we enhance our service in ways that where people want to come back when they feel safe to do so.
Derek, we've been pushing people, especially in smaller communities, to try to get ridership up, try to get people on the bus. Do you think that is going to be more difficult in the future?
I really don't. I'm more positive that we will continue to build on our ridership success. Last year, we had hit our highest annual ridership on our fixed route since 2001. And during that about 18-year window, we've had service reductions, we've cut routes, we've modified things, had fare increases. And so, you know, this pandemic is I guess, a hurdle in our service. But, you know, the track record that we've at least had over the last 8 years of building ridership and growing and creating new partnerships and making our services easier and more dependable for our customers, I think really puts us in a nice position to rebuild after this pandemic. We're certainly looking at other opportunities at this point, such as mobile payment options, tokenless transportation, especially for our ADA customers. So I think we're going to continue to build on some of the great things that we have done in a small urban system. And like Justin said, short term, I think there's going to be a decrease as people start to or continue to feel safe to use public transportation. That will grow. And there's also that that demographic that will not drive or can't drive. And so we will retain those. But I think we're also going to keep building on those choice riders as well.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, and I'd like to say welcome to Wisconsin, Justin. It's the first time Justin and I have had an opportunity to talk.
So might as well do it on the radio. Justin Steuenberg, General Manager of Metro Transit. Derek Mick there, Transit and Marketing Director of the City of Sheboygan. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about employee policies and workplace legal situations amid the pandemic. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Are employers required to follow social distancing protocols to ensure both workers and customers remain 6 feet away from each other? Are businesses required to provide employees with PPE like masks or face shields? Can you ask your workplace for an accommodation that would make it safer to do your job if you have an underlying medical condition, like, say, a private office instead of a cube or staggering shifts? So many questions to get at. What are yours in the area of labor law? We're at 800-642-1234. Eric Eisenman is partner at the Milwaukee law firm Hush Blackwell, where he heads the firm's labor and employment practice. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, in what circumstances do employees have the right to not return to their work site and their job and receive unemployment benefits instead? What does that look like?
So this is one of the biggest questions that we've been seeing as we're sort of entering the new phase of return to work over the last couple weeks. The short answer is that it's a fairly high standard. It's a difficult argument for an employee to make if she or he is fearful about returning to work and wants to still remain eligible to receive benefits. The way that the system is structured is that in most instances, if the employer is reopening, if there is work available for an employee, then she's going to have an obligation to return. Now, the caveat and the question that we're getting is, you know, what if the employer hasn't taken sufficient steps to make my workplace safe? Has the employer implemented environmental changes in the workplace? You just alluded to it in your intro in terms of reconfiguring the space, putting up partitions, and beginning to implement rules about wearing masks or social distancing. In an extreme situation where the employer is not creating a safe workplace, that employee could raise a concern. She could file a complaint with an agency like the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
OSHA,
Exactly. And so there might be a basis there. The other category that we see is if someone has actually a bona fide medical condition. If you are somebody with a suppressed immune system, if you've got a respiratory issue or something else that puts you in a high risk category and you are not medically able to return to work for fear of being exposed during the pandemic, there is discretion that the state agency would have, and you might still be eligible for benefits in that category as well.
But just because you're in an upper age group, you're in your 60s or 70s, that wouldn't deem you necessarily immediately qualified for saying, no, I'll get assistance and not go back to work.
Exactly. That's the toughest question, I would say. There have been some states like Iowa, our neighbor, for instance, where the governor has explicitly come out and said, you know, if your employer reopens and your job is available and you choose not to come, you are not eligible. Wisconsin has not been so explicit. But if you look at the unemployment eligibility rules, in most instances, even a legitimate fear, like what you just described, of somebody who might be in a higher risk category, it's going to be difficult for them to continue to remain eligible if their employer has that work available.
So if that employee is deemed ineligible to receive those unemployment benefits, what legal recourse do they have?
Well, to the extent that they are, again, if they're suffering from a COVID-related illness or they're taking care of an individual with COVID, they might be able to qualify for benefits under the new federal legislation that was passed back in April, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. If their employer is under 500 employees, but generally over 50 employees, that 50 to 500 threshold is the one we're looking at, the employer is probably subject to that law, and the employee might be eligible to take paid leave, either for their own illness related to COVID or, as I mentioned, caring for somebody, or expanded family leave if they need to stay home to take care of a child who's at home because of a school closure.
We're talking with Eric Eisenman about what employers and employees should know as businesses open back up in Wisconsin. Eric's a labor and employment attorney in Milwaukee. Have you filed for unemployment? Have you been receiving your checks? Are you a business owner? Are you concerned for your workers and those who may not return? Join in with your labor law questions, 800-642-1234. Matt called in from Johnson Creek wanting to address that people who work from home right now could be working overtime longer than they did in the office. So, Eric, how might employers deal with that overtime? What can employees do to address the situation?
Good question. A lot of us, I think, that have shifted from the office setting to the remote work setting, and I find myself in that same category, are often seeing the workday blend into the home day, right? So, we're working in the evenings or we're working in times we wouldn't have previously because the computer's right there. The threshold question that an individual or an employer has to ask is whether the worker is an exempt employee, somebody who falls in the salaried category under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, where we would pay them a fixed rate, a fixed salary, or a non-exempt employee, someone who's an hourly employee. If you're an exempt employee, a salaried employee, then your compensation is going to remain the same regardless of how many hours you work in a given work week. So if you find yourself working more from home, the short answer is that's unfortunately part of the deal. If you are a non-exempt employee, however, if you're an hourly employee, the fact that you may be working remotely does not alter the fact that you are still eligible for overtime if you're working more than 40 hours in a given work week. So if an employer has remote workers who are hourly, that employer is going to need to have a system in place whereby they're able to monitor the hours that are actually being worked. And even if an employer says you're not allowed or you're only scheduled to work 40 hours, but that non-exempt employee works more than 40 hours, she would actually be entitled to that overtime compensation for those extra hours worked. Employers will attempt to sort of clearly communicate those expectations. And they have, if a person is consistently working more than they're supposed to, the employer can take corrective action, discipline against that employee, but they still have to pay for that extra time worked.
So some people are returning to work without having their unemployment claims processed yet, the unemployment assistant backlog not kicking in. Can they still receive those paychecks in the future?
Yes, and this is one of the very frustrating things that folks are experiencing as the state of Wisconsin and virtually all states are dealing with this, unprecedented number of claims. The state is hiring people to process these unemployment claims, trying to train people, but there's still a substantial backlog, as you mentioned. The guidance that the state has issued has said that as long as you complete your application timely, that is to say that you submit that application during a period when you would be eligible for benefits, even if you're not able to receive those benefits because of the lag in processing time and you get it and you're able to return to work, you should still be receiving that check for that time that you were eligible. So you might not have it in hand now, but if there was a period of time where you were out of work, where you submitted at a proper application and were eligible, you should still be paid for that time.
Well, let's take a call here. Jay is in Two Rivers. Hi, Jay.
Good morning. My wife applied for unemployment March 15th, and due to an error from the unemployment office, she was initially denied, but they cleared that up, and she finally just this week got her unemployment card, but has been unable to activate it. Have you any suggestions?
A good question. You know, I think you are suffering, or she's suffering, like a lot of folks are, as a result of sort of the backlog. You know, we have been having even difficulty in our office in getting folks from the unemployment department on the phone when we've got questions. I think that, you know, continuing to attempt to communicate with the office by phone, by email, the various different ways that we can do that would be my recommendation. The peace of mind that I could give is, you know, given that she has the card, given that you've got that determination that she was eligible, similar to the question that Kate just posed, she should be receiving benefits for that period of time.
Jay,
so other than...
Yeah, and Jay, is there any phone number on the back of the card?
Yes, and she did try calling and emailing.
And couldn't get through to someone.
That's right. I think she left a message. And regarding the federal contribution of $600 per week, is that supposed to come in the mail, or is that going to be included on her card? Because so far that didn't show up.
That's a good question, Jay, and one that we're getting a lot. So this $600 that Jay mentioned was a result of the Federal CARES Act that was passed. It was an additional benefit of $600 above the regular benefit that an individual would receive under the state unemployment structure. That is in effect through July 31st. And to Jay's question, that is implemented and paid through the states. So it's a federal benefit, but it is going to be paid by the state agency. So in your case, Jay, for your wife, that should get paid along with the state benefit.
But it may be on a different timeline, it sounds like.
Well, because it's administered through the state, uh-huh. My sense is that you're probably not going to receive it any faster than you would the state benefits.
Okay. And in Jay's situation, it wasn't coupled together, that, you know, it wasn't coming together. So maybe that money is dropped in on a different timeline?
It's possible. It's
okay.
Possible. My sense and experience has been that those are typically being paid together. But,
okay.
You know, I would say, Jay, if and when you are successful in getting a live person to answer that question, that would be a good one to ask.
We're talking with Milwaukee labor attorney Eric Eisenman about employee rights, workplace policies in this era of COVID. Do you have a labor lawyer helping you with your unemployment situation? What's at the heart of the dispute? Have you been laid off or furloughed? What information coming from your employer is confusing to you or contradicting what you're hearing elsewhere? Do you care for a child at home? Can't return to work due to lack of childcare? What are you learning from your employer? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Eric Eisenman right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So many workplace questions. We're looking at your labor law issues with Eric Eisenman. He's an attorney who works on cases involving labor and employment, and he stays with us. Let's get back to your questions. Carlene is in Madison.
Oh,
hi, Carlene.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. What is your question?
I have a question. I won't say where I work. But anyways, I had a doctor's note, the whole nine yards, and filled out a COVID-19 packet, and I'm high risk. And I sent it in, did everything I was supposed to do with it. And in a matter of minutes, I was denied. And I just want to know my rights.
And when you say you had a whole packet, you had a doctor's note, I understand.
Right, a doctor's note, and there was about 3 pages in the packet that I had to fill out for the COVID-19, and I was denied, and I'm high risk.
All right, Carlene, thank you. Eric, any suggestions there?
So I guess the question would be, when Carlene says she's denied it, do we think that she was denied from her unemployment benefits, or was she denied paid leave from her employer? Is Carlene still with us?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
Sure. Yes, yeah. When you say you were denied, Carlene, what were you denied for?
I was just denied from working at home. They said I would have to take a leave of absence or something, but I don't. Do you get paid for that?
All right, Carlene, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. So this is a good question, right? Is that somebody who is at an elevated risk or has a medical issue like Carlene does, and requests for her employer that she have an accommodation to be able to perform her job from home. There are some jobs that the remote work has been fairly seamless. There's others where it's difficult to perform your jobs from home. And in the pre-COVID world, there was a fair body of case law that said that, an employee isn't automatically entitled to a work from home accommodation unless they had a bona fide medical reason for that, and that the working from home did not create an undue hardship on the employer. Here, in the last couple of months, we've seen a lot of jobs shifting from home. And what I would say, shifting to home, and what I would say is that it is going to be easier for an employee to argue that she can perform her job from home because, we're all sort of, doing a little bit more teleworking than we used to be. In Carlene's case, or in a case of somebody who's got that medical issue, an employer is typically going to have an obligation to engage in what they call the interactive process to analyze what that person's medical condition is, whether it's a bona fide request that's supported by medical information to be able to work remotely, and then whether the employer can accommodate that job, whether that person can do that from home. And in many instances, like I said now, since we're going to have a body of evidence saying that a lot of these jobs can be performed in whole or in part remotely, the employer may have an obligation to grant that kind of request.
Carlene, thank you. Let's bring in Kelly now in Milwaukee. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good.
So my question is, I'm a healthcare professional, and I was brought back to work prior to safer at home being lifted before that was all, taken away by the legislature. And I raised some concerns, workplace safety concerns. And my employer told me that my concerns were not valid because they were not legally mandated, because OSHA has issued guidance and not guidelines, and so they're not enforceable. Could you comment on that?
Yes, yeah, and this is a sort of still a muddy area, as you've experienced firsthand. OSHA is a federal agency that is fairly slow-moving, like a lot of state and federal agencies can be. And it's correct that OSHA has not issued a specific rule or regulation addressing the COVID pandemic in the workplace. There was a lawsuit that was filed about a week or two ago by the labor unions, AFL-CIO, asking OSHA to implement the temporary rule addressing this. I think that's probably unlikely to happen. But what we are seeing is OSHA does still have enforcement authority under what's called the General Duty Clause of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. So what you're seeing is in workplaces where there is a real issue, where an employer is failing to take appropriate action to keep its employees safe, OSHA has the authority and actually is conducting investigations and responses to employee complaints. So even though there's not a specific standard on point, OSHA still does have that power. The clarifier, the caveat I would say is that you can imagine there are a lot of complaints being made right now to OSHA.
Right.
So their resources are strained, and I think it is a challenge for them to respond to all of the issues that employees are raising. But the takeaway is that if you do have a real fear that there is an issue in your workplace, you still do have the ability to file a complaint, and OSHA may investigate.
Eric Eisenman, a labor and employment attorney in Milwaukee. We're looking at the workplace situations and labor law amid the pandemic. Let's go to Brad now in Sockville. Hi, Brad.
Hi.
What's your question?
I'm calling because my question was, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
My question is, I'm a seasonal worker. My season ended October 27th. And my regular UI benefits ended on March 28th. Now, because I had already gone through my entire UI benefits, there was no application for me to fill out regarding the unemployment during for the 5 weeks that I was out of work. Now, because I was not able to fill out an application during what would be an eligible period of time for me, does that mean that the back weeks from March 28th to up until the point when I started working, I will not be able to qualify for because I was not able to fill out an application in a timely manner due to the system?
Mm.
So that's a good question. And the state kind of addresses that issue in some of its guidance. You know, the devil's in the details here. You know, if you attempted to submit an application, if you accessed and completed and submitted an application, you know, you should be eligible for benefits if you were otherwise eligible under the guidelines. If you were able to start an application but couldn't finish it or couldn't submit it, I think that's going to be a more challenging situation for you because they're going to say, you know, that completed application is the benchmark to be eligible. That said, you may be aware that the Federal CARES Act expanded eligibility for unemployment. So some individuals, independent contractors, seasonal workers who were losing opportunities as a result of the economic slowdown were eligible for benefits when they might not have previously been. So my advice would probably be to continue to pursue that claim to see whether you're able to show that you began that application process because you might be eligible and the rules might be a little bit relaxed compared to what they would have previously been.
Brad, thank you for the call. Eric, only some daycares are open. Schools remain closed. What can workers do if they can't return to work because they don't have childcare?
This is a huge question because we're coming up on the end of the school year. So I mentioned before that the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, this FFCRA, the federal legislation, which created a paid leave for individuals for their own COVID-related illnesses, and an additional paid leave, extended family and medical leave for people taking care of kids with their schools were closed. The question is, when school is out and some daycares are open, is someone who could be receiving those paid benefits under the FFCRA still eligible or still able to receive those benefits? And I think that employers are going to be analyzing this on a case-by-case basis. I think that there is a risk that employers are going to be able to say, now that school is done, an individual, you know, would typically have alternative care plans for their child during the summer. Some daycares are open, so we're going to expect you to return to work, and that person may not be eligible to continue to receive those paid benefits. So I think that's a challenge that a lot of workers are going to be facing.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a great weekend.
You too. Stay well. Eric Eisenman, partner at the Milwaukee law firm Hush Blackwell, where he heads the firm's labor and employment practice. Just ahead, we take a trip on the wild side. Love snakes, snails, rats, toads, and bugs. We have two animal experts, plus Wild Krat star Chris Kratt. Give us the lowdown on animals that creep, crawl, slink, and slither. So do you have a rat, a hedgehog, a turtle, snake, ferret, a pet lizard? What's their name? What are they like? Call in 800-642-1234 for our Creature Hour. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and we're slithering on the Ideas Network.